Welcome back, everybody, to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am your co-host, Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host with the good microphone on a Thursday. It's Tim Goodman, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Tim.
Hello, Jason.
It's good to be back on a Thursday again. Again, this is how we do it now. We're tight. We're bright. We're energetic. It's Thursday. The week has not crushed us. Has not beaten our spirits down yet.
The whole reason for our success now is Thursday, not Friday.
Yeah, that's it.
We figured it out two something years later.
We're floating down the Thursday river now. Okay, we've got a couple of shows that you watch that we're going to talk about. We got a couple of letters. It's probably going to be a tight and bright kind of episode. But the big story is that Game of Thrones ended. And you have been writing about it. You have been linking every week to your piece that said endings are hard and this is a no-win scenario and everybody's going to complain because, of course, they are. And now that it's ended and you've seen it and I've seen it, and amid all the hubbub of people who are angry about Game of Thrones, I will say, just to be, I'm going to throw that out there. I've definitely read some stories from people where it's clear that they're grasping for negative things to write about Game of Thrones because they know that that's what the people want, that the blood is in the water and they got to write negative things about Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah. No doubt.
Even though I'm not sure they actually believe them, but they know they need to write that. So I ask you, who has been somewhat contrarian about this, how do you think they stuck the landing?
I think they'd stuck it about as well as they could, and better than I expected, maybe, because I think that the penultimate episode was off the mark, and if that had continued, I think, more in that realm, I would have been disappointed. I think it was a nice course correction, the finale. And, you know, one day, Jason, we'll be able to evaluate this series finale and season finale, but the series finale, in a way where we're not so connected to the sort of like shock and awe that Twitter dropped on this. And I tried to remind people in the story that I wrote is that it's an outsized influencer and a magnet. And of course it influences other media outlets, I'm sure THR as well, where it's like, everybody on Twitter says it's terrible. Let's write a bunch of stories about how terrible it is, or let's amplify how terrible it is. But when you talk to people who actually really like the show, for the most part, they were fine with it. In fact, some of them loved it, and most of them seem to have loved it. So it's trying to get a judge that you can't let Twitter be the dominant thing. And besides, a lot of the arguments that I find on Twitter are you know, they're emotional, and I get that. They're not reasoned, and I don't expect them to be this close to the finale. And a lot of people who were watching Game of Thrones were not like watching it like they might have watched, say, Mad Men, like critically thinking in that respect, or even, well, I couldn't say Sopranos because the Sopranos was legendary, as we've talked about before, in how it split the audience into people who thought it was a mob show, which it wasn't, and people who looked at it as, much more of a therapy and internal story about Tony and his marriage, but mostly about Tony and the demons that he was battling, which is what really the story was about. And so, the people who wanted to be more mob-like were frustrated, and a lot of people didn't like the ending because they don't like ambiguity. And they don't want to read into things, basically. So at least on this one, I think that a lot of Game of Thrones fans are looking at it so super emotional because it was so recently. But a lot of them just don't have a sense of like how a season is structured, how the television industry works. I think one of the legit arguments that they can say is it was rushed. Well, I would say go back and look at pretty much every single season of every great show, it was rushed because you think you're going to get there and then you don't get there. For Game of Thrones, they had to take some shortcuts. They definitely made some mistakes. By no means was this a perfect ending or a perfect season. Certainly not a perfect way to go out for the show. the problems that people are frustrated with now mostly might have come from the previous season, where however they arced it out. But I would argue, because this is, I think, is the central point of why people are upset, I would argue, Jason, that they mapped it out in a way that they thought they were wrapping it up well. But sometimes when you write stuff and then you see it, and whatever changes you're making, you're realizing, yeah, we kind of needed more runway, and we don't have it, so we got to do the best we can. And I think that maybe accounts for some of the stuff in the penultimate episode. I do think Danny's storyline was perfectly fine, but I don't think Jamie's was fine, and everyone can find some gripes then, here and there. But overall, when the whole thing ends and you see what's happening to everybody, yeah, I thought it was fine. I thought it was actually a really good ending.
Yeah, I agree. I did a nearly 2-hour long podcast on Monday night about it that people can check out if they want. That's TV episode 570. I liked it. My co-host Brian liked it. Not a perfect ending for sure, but I think some remarkable television the last couple of weeks. This is a landmark series that I think went out and provided an ending, because it had to provide an ending. Back to your original column about this, you can't not end it, so you have to do something to get to a place where you can say, and this is where the story ends, and then you don't get to see anymore. Even though obviously life goes on, this story is at an end. That's really hard to do. I think they did. Yeah, I think I definitely felt the furniture moving moment, where you could tell that they were switching from telling a story forward to calculating backward from an ending. Mm-hmm. And that's super awkward. It happens. It happens in every arc show, every Netflix show. You can get that moment. It's about 2/3 of the way through where you're like, things are weird right now. It's like, oh, they've gone from moving forward to calculating backward. I think they should have taken more episodes. And I read somewhere that HBO said, take as many episodes as you want. You can do more. And the theory is that they already had their Star Wars deal, and they're like, nope, we're done. This is it. We're just going to do 13 and be done. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I think they outlined it thinking this is all the episodes they needed, and then they got into the details, and then they had to cut corners because there was more there than they maybe anticipated. But I was pretty happy with the end. I had seen some speculation about one of the possibilities for who could be the king at the end that turned out to be right. And therefore, I didn't have a reaction of like, what? It seemed reasonable. And the idea, Daenerys's arc, if you look back, I think it happened maybe a little faster than I would have liked, but I think if you look back through the eyes of somebody who knows where she's going, you can see that they did actually set it up. And you might not have liked it, but she was burning people alive and torturing people from the very beginning. Yeah. And is it really as surprising? And then in terms of John, I really liked that this show doesn't do what they, you know, what would have been the default, right? Which is that he's our big hero, and and we're going to spoil it here. So why, if you listen to this point, if you really want to listen, you should skip ahead a little bit in this episode. But he kills her in the finale. He kills her because she is going to be a brutal dictator who is going to burn a lot of people alive with her dragon. And he decides that he can't do that. And what's great is that he doesn't like climb on the dragon and say, now I'm the king, and yay, they lived happily ever after. He pays a price. He punishes himself. He's a broken man when he's in the cell. Every time you see him after that, John is kind of a ruined guy. And the last shot of the last episode of Game of Thrones is your hero as a broken man riding off into the wilderness in the north, never to be seen again. And I think that's a bold narrative move to take your hero and basically say he doesn't get to come out on top. He has to sacrifice himself for the greater good, and he'll never be the same after that. Like, that's great. That's actually, I think, a really great ending, but I think it just gets lost in the hype of everybody having their hottest of takes about every single development of every single episode of this season.
Sure, and that's I've been through this before. I was even back when I was participating in, full blown,
your deconstructions.
Yeah, I was doing those, and for even when I was doing it in Mad Men, I was saying, this is not how it's supposed to be. We should not be deconstructing every episode and passing judgment on this final season before we see it as a whole. And, you know, I mean, that's partly why I don't do those things anymore, and who has time. But I just don't think that that's like a really good use of criticism. But beyond that, to the Danny question, I think it's ridiculous. Anybody who thought Danny was going to be the queen was not paying attention. And anybody who thought that she was nice and was going to make a good queen was also not paying attention. So did she, you know, look, I've read some very hot, angry takes about that. And I was just like, no, you are letting your passion for this character you liked to overcome whatever critical thinking you're doing here, because they had set it up that Dany was wanted all the power. She didn't want to share it. She had a mean streak. I don't think that she went quote unquote crazy. I don't buy that thing. I think that she was just like, you have what I want. You are my biggest rival for Cersei, and I'm gonna torch this place.
It was calculated. She literally says in the penultimate episode, the only ways I can win are love or fear. Mm-hmm. And John won't give her love because John is beloved, and she can kind of make a play with they're gonna love me because they're mm-hmm. gonna love us.
Right.
And John, says basically is like not into that, which, you know, that would be my criticism, is that it comes off as this incredibly long plot about her dream of retaking the throne she believes she deserves ends up hinging on whether a boy likes her or not. Like, I don't like that part of it, but mm-hmm. but you can't say she's not motivated, because in that moment she says, okay, fear then, right? Like, she's decided the only way that anyone will accept her as the ruler at this point, given all of this, is by instilling fear. And that's why she destroys the city. And, you know, that is a choice. It's not, not perfect, but it's there. I think people are also cranky because they feel fooled. Because they were fooled by the storytellers, because the storytellers know that you want to root for her, and they know it's this amazing underdog story, and they're playing you. They're playing you by your expectations of that, so that you can be taken aback when she does a horrible thing and you have to rethink everything you thought about her. And you know what? I get it. Some people don't like feeling like the show manipulated them and twisted something until you got to an unexpected conclusion that you don't like. But that's
drama.
What happened? Yep, that's it.
that's drama.
Uh huh.
it's not called pleasing you for your expectations. And you know, there's some layers to this. It's like people took ownership of the show, which it's their right to be super fans. But when you take ownership of the show and you think, this is my show, this is how I want it to end, yeah, this is how it should end because I say so, you are setting yourself up for a massive letdown, which is what happened to a lot of people. But also, it's unrealistic because you're not letting the series creators finish their vision. It's ridiculous to think that you control the show and that they can't be invested in finishing it the way they wanted to. And as a side, it's also ridiculous for a lot of people that I read, like, they should have given it to somebody else. That's not how it works. This is their show. And people just are assuming outside of Hollywood that, like, oh, the entire cast wants to go on for another 8 years. They're also assuming that the rest of the cast believes that if they brought in two different writers, everything would be fine. That's totally not how it. Yeah. That's not how it is.
And stories have endings. I mean, stories have endings.
Yeah,
this is George R. R. Martin's ending. I mean,
yeah,
right. I'm sure it's modified to some degree, but this is, they were working on George R. R. Martin's outline. Mm-hmm. And when asked about this afterward, or I think he posted on his blog, he basically said, is this the end of the books? Are the books going to end this way? And he says, yes and no and yes and no and yes and no. Right. Like, of course, it won't be the same. There are other characters. But, you know, this was how the story is supposed to end. And mm-hmm. the line, you said it. I mean, there is, within fan culture especially, look, if it didn't meet your expectations and you don't like where it went, that's valid. Everybody gets to have an opinion. You're right. And you don't have to like it. But there is a sense of ownership that I think happens in some fan cultures that is fascinating, where, as you said, they believe that they have ownership over the work and the art, and that And that's not it. You have the ownership over your interpretation of the art, but the artist gets to create the work, and then you judge it. And you can judge it harshly, but you know, they are the ones who make those calls. And there's, in fact, this is in the text of the show, toward the end, where Tyrion is hauled out of his cell in front of all the lords and Grey Worm, and they're debating the fate of Jon Snow. And Grey Worm's like, he needs justice, he needs to die, he lists all the things that have to happen to Jon. And Tyrion turns to Grey Worm and says, it's not for you to decide.
Right.
And the fact is, that's the message for fans, too. Mm-hmm. It's not right. for you to decide. You can judge the decision, but it's not your decision.
Right. And it's like, you know, and to me, I mean, again, everybody has an opinion and whether, you know.
Yeah, it didn't work for you. It didn't work for you.
Yeah, if it didn't work for you, that's totally fine. I think that people will come back to the ending and perhaps like it a little bit better. But one of the things that sort of drove me crazy, and I started seeing this from people who are allegedly sort of seasoned people who cover the, you know, the industry, where they would, they, you know, they looked at it and they said, well, you know, it didn't make sense that like how did everybody get there to you know, to judge him so quickly? Like how did they get everybody there at the end? And you know, and my feeling was like, okay, you do know this is the last episode of the last the show. You can't spend 3 weeks getting everybody on a ship and getting everybody to come there. I'm sorry, it's just the shorthand necessary.
I want to say it's the New York Times piece that I'll just lay it out. That's what I was talking about, where I read a story that felt very much like somebody was desperately trying to find things to be negative about because they knew that everybody wanted to be negative. The one that I got was, yes, it was that same thing, which is, I want to see the messages tied to the legs of the ravens that are sent to all the lords, and then I want to see the ravens fly, and I want to see them go to their destination, and I want to see the lords pack their bags and then get on their ships or get in their carriages or whatever they do, and then go, and they get there late, so they gotta like get a dinner, and then maybe hot pie, I'll bake them a pie, and then the morning they get up and they have a breakfast, and then they go to the dragon pit, and then they have the meeting. I want to see that. And it's like, no, you don't want to see that. Not a plot hole. That is not that is something nobody needs to see.
Right. And like, some stuff is legitimate, but it's also, you have to say, you know what, it's the last episode. They could have planned it better. Well, okay, why don't you write 73 episodes and then you plan it better? That's part of it. Like this thing where they say, well, why didn't the Unsullied just kill Jon? Well, that's probably a good choice. I mean, they were killing people in the street, so why when they found that he killed the queen, however they found that out, since they didn't have the dragon or the body, like, why didn't they just kill him? Well, we don't know. Well, and that's not a big issue right now.
Also,
that's,
it's like, two foreign armies with no leader in a foreign land, right? He's leverage. And they use him as leverage. So we could go into that, right? But like, that's not the story they want to tell. So they're like, you know, you can fill it in. Just let it go. I can think of a lot of really obvious reasons why, but
yes,
you know, they don't all have to be in there.
And that's the thing. When you get these hot takes on Twitter, they're like, this would never happen. And then all I want to say back to them is like, what you should do is like, take 10 minutes, disconnect, unplug all your stuff, 10, 15 minutes, sit down and ask yourself, just think, put your hands on your head and think, is there any other way that this, did it have to happen that way? Could there have been other variables? And you will come away from that saying, well, yeah, sure, there. Yeah, this could have happened or that could happen. Okay, then. Look, well, if they could have happened, then how do you know that they didn't happen? They just don't have time to show that. So it's like, this is not the, like when they say, oh, well, they would have killed John. You don't know that. That's not actually true. And so if you nitpick something like that at the end, you're just going to frustrate me because I'm saying all shows have to end. This one had to end. They were running out of time. So they took some shortcuts. Okay, like sue them. Like, every great series has taken
shortcuts. Valid narrative decision to take. I mean, I love that they skip 3 weeks, right? And and then they drag Tyrion out of his cell, and we see what's been going on in the meantime. We don't need to have seen the setup there. That is a good bit of narrative gap that you can just fill in with what you see next. They don't need to explain that. Yeah, I look, something I've learned in talking about this for almost 10 years and TV and movies and stuff, and that you have certainly learned over all of your time as a TV critic, is there are times when the spell is broken. You talk about the buy-in moment where you either buy in or you don't. Mm-hmm. Yep. Obviously, something this season or things this season caused people to fall out, to cash out, to have the spell broken. And once the spell is broken, especially if you've been watching a show for a long time and you feel like an obligation, well, there's only three more episodes left, even though I'm angry, I'm going to keep watching. Once the spell is broken, you are going to sit there and just complain about everything, because the fact is, most filmed entertainment is not a perfect puzzle box. There are always things you can nitpick if you really want to. The trick is, the magic trick of a great piece of art is that you never want to. But once the spell is broken, yeah, I get it. I just, for me, although I definitely have criticisms about it, I was not going into the finale starting to like seek ways to find fault with it. And as a result, I was satisfied by it. And I feel bad for people who watched 70 odd episodes or whatever of TV, and then in the last two or three just got completely frustrated and decided that they hated it, because that's too bad. I'm sorry you didn't get to the end and have a positive journey, but I did. I thought that they handled it pretty well. I'm going to say very similarly to what I feel about Lost, which is, I'm not sure the last season was great, but I thought that it ended in a good place.
I thought it did, too. To me, the finale was better than I expected it to be, given the penultimate episode, as I said. And I loved what they did with telling that story and having you get closure on most of the characters there.
Yeah, it's all characters, right?
Like, it's all characters. It's all about that.
It's very much the shape of The Wire and some other shows, where they get the climax in the penultimate episode, and then the final episode of a season or a series is the fallout, and it's all about how it affects the characters. And yes, there is an assassination of a major character that happens, or a murder of a major character that happens in this episode, but you know what? That is also just character fallout from the previous episode. And just like people walking around, looks on their faces, long conversations with these characters. And like, I thought that was great. I didn't want a big fight and a climactic moment and that's the end of the show. I really wanted to see them grapple with the issues of the show, right down to the fact, and I've held this since I read the books way back when, right as the first season was coming out. Like, you got to talk about how the whole system is unjust. And there's that moment where Sam says, what if we let people vote? And all the lords just laugh. Because, you know, and that, I feel like you've got to do that. You've got to point out, this whole system is ridiculous. It's bad. And then Tyrion's like, okay, well, that's not going to work. How about a compromise?
Yeah, exactly. And I loved how they showed every character's thing. And to its credit, so... And I would even ask people who didn't like the ending to consider a couple of things. One is that, you know, the whole notion that women were somehow diminished in this ending just because Dany died is ridiculous. First of all, there were so many empowering moments in it, and Sansa's independence and staying as the Queen of the North was really, I thought, an excellent decision on the story.
Right.
Arya continuing to be her own completely independent badass and sailing west of Westeros, I think, was a great idea. You know, and then the idea that I also really loved about Jon, he's technically the person who tried to do everything right. And a lot of sort of, for lack of a better word, good Samaritans get themselves killed, and they get in the positions where they want to do something good, and then it implodes on them, and there's a sense there of like, it's unjust that happened. And they put the decision on him that, you know, she has to go, and he had to do it. And then he has to face the fallout. What I liked about extending the story, and I don't know if we have similar readings on how it ended or just, you know, variations on the theme of what you had said earlier, but I like the fact that John took his punishment. He got there, and then he was like, yeah, now this isn't happening.
Yeah.
Like, these people, I can live in, you know, we've vanquished, you know, the Night King. I can live with the free folk north of the wall. He's from the north already, and they have set it up before that he's technically, you know, king of the north in many ways for the free folk as well. And so, like, you can see him, he makes he suffers he plays by the rules and he suffers like, okay, you're right. I have to take this fall for the betterment of the kingdoms, like six kingdoms. And Tyrion basically says, you have to do this to make it right. And so he does it. But when he gets there, he realizes, I did what I needed to do, but I'm going to do no one any good sitting, staring off in the Night Watch. And I take back my life and I decide that, you know what? I'm not staying here. I'm taking all these people. I'm going with all these people and we're going to go north. And there's redemption in that as well. There's like, he's not a victim. He's, you know, he's not just a fall guy now. He's not just somebody who was like, I'm heroic, so I'm going to climb up on the cross and bear this. He's like, yeah, I bared most of it, but I think this part's ridiculous. And now I take back my future and I walk with these people north. Mm-hmm. The unspoken thing is he could be their leader. So in some ways, he does become, in some sense, a king, a leader, however that they want to determine it. And I love that aspect of the double part of choosing his own fate, his own freedom, and then also by making that decision may end up in a similar position anyway.
Right. And he's stepping out of that society, which is so messed up and has done him wrong. And he's done. He's like, I'm not going to be a part of this. I'm not like the Night's Watch too. It's like, is there one? Like, mm-hmm. does there need to be one? And he gets there and it's there's nobody there, but the free
there's
folk.
No need for it. Yeah.
And it's like, let's just go. And it's actually a really great callback to some great stuff with him and Ygritte when he was mm-hmm. in the North, right? Like mm-hmm. he lived there with those people and now he's going to go back there. And I think, mm-hmm. I think it's actually a great way to have that bittersweet ending of the hero finally having succeeded and paid the ultimate price, the penultimate price. He didn't die, but he, like, his life is over. He's going to have to go into exile, essentially, and having him say, I did what I needed to do. I'm done. I'm out of here.
Right. And the episode before, Tormund or whatever his name was, basically said, you're one of us.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And just think of the parties those guys are going to have up there.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
It's mm-hmm. going to be good.
Bro time.
Anyway, Game of Thrones, I think it's going to be viewed as a landmark of television history. Once we get a little space in the rear view here. Want to talk about some other stuff that's not necessarily a historical landmark? How about that?
So true.
All right.
So true.
We'll start with your review, which is already up, of The Name of the Rose, another adaptation of Umberto Eco's religious murder mystery. There was that Sean Connery movie in 1986 about 86? This.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's back. So what is up here?
Well, you know, the movie, for the most part, was considered not very good. You know, it just didn't really. And then Umberto Eco of the original movie said, you know, I think he used some terminology about making a club sandwich and they didn't use any of the ingredients. They just like used the lettuce and the bun, something like that. I'm sure I'm messing that up. But he basically said, my book was full of all these twists and turns and all the, and then the movie could only do one. Well, of course it could only do thing. It was a 2-hour movie.
Right.
And this sprawling, very complicated story that he did, which a lot of people don't like because it's all over the map with philosophy and religion and stuff. To me, I said, there's no wonder no one has redone it until now in 2019 from 1986. And part of that is, I think it's because John Turturro must have had this as his passion project, because not only, you know, this is Sundance just acquired this. This was made in Italy with some German financing and production. And, you know, Italy and Bavaria being central to the themes of The Name of the Rose, the book. And so that makes a lot of sense. But Turturro, it must be his passion project, because not only does he star in it and executive produce it, he also wrote it with three other people. So you've got four writers working on eight episodes. John Turturro is among them. And they're trying to make sense out of this gigantic, convoluted novel. But the problem with an international series, Jason, and you've seen a number of these, mm-hmm. is that they don't look – they're not as polished as British series or American series for the most part. A lot of them are. But this is – this show, this miniseries, feels like a throwback to like 10 years ago television. And it also has a really big divide in the in the performances, the acting performances. So you have some people who feel like they're acting in a stage play, and so it's very showy. And then you have some people who are acting in a movie. You also have some untrained actors, some young actors. It's kind of a it's really erratic and kind of a mess across the board. You've got a voiceover. You have some kind of crazy images where there's like a fugue state that doesn't really work. And then you have a lot of Sherlock Holmes exposition, because it's basically a Sherlock Holmes story, and that there's been a murder at an abbey. And as much as Turturro, who is an excellent actor and has done some really great stuff recently, is trying to keep this together, he just can't, you know? He just can't get it together.
All right, well, so Sundance, it's there if you want it, but... All right, how about another one? What/If on Netflix with Renee Zellweger?
Well, let's put it, that starts Friday on Netflix. And first of all, the first thing that needs to be said is it's a disaster, like from the, literally from the opening shot. And it's set in San Francisco. And it's funny, but I want to disabuse people of the notion, because usually when something's really terrible, they want to see if they should watch it for the joke part. I would disabuse you of that. It's a really bad network series. And it has problems in ways that, like, say The Name of the Rose doesn't. The Name of the Rose isn't very good. There's choices that they make. For example, Michael Emerson from Lost. We know Michael Emerson well. Michael Emerson looks like he plays an abbot in The Name of the Rose, and he's speaking like he's on Lost. Uh-huh. Right? So he's clearly one of the only Americans in the class other than John Turturro, and he's speaking it with an American accent like he's on Lost. And John Turturro is supposed to be English, but he's actually adopting some like kind of European, generic European non-accent accent. And those are just decisions you make that you probably regret as a filmmaker, or casting like inexperienced people to play young lovers, and it's a mess. But like, what if the problem on this one is just it miscalculates a lot of things. First of all, it's a terrible network show, essentially, that I think Netflix wanted to buy because they're like, you know what? A lot of people eat those kind of, you know, soapy stuff things up. Let's get one. It is also basically a ripoff of Indecent Proposal, like directly. And they even reference it. They even reference the fact that it's a ripoff. And Renee Zellweger, I'm going to try to be very, very careful when I phrase this, because, you know, she plays a kind of power hungry sex pot. But what happens is it illuminates two things. One, she's not really good in that role. She's not really a great actress. I think she's good in perfect roles that used to be perfectly timed to her sort of like. I don't want, you know, kind of like sweet girlishness or whatever, or like funny. She's not basically a powerful sex kitten kind of thing. It really comes off as like wince inducing. And I would say that with the same thing if there was a man in the role who was well past. I mean, it could be like a Hugh, you know, Hugh Laurie, that's not going to work. But, you know, like there are aging Lotharios on the male side that wouldn't fit this role either. It's just, you know, it doesn't work. And every time that they come back to her to be this, like, I am a billionaire VC funding woman, and the only way that I'll fund your project is if you let me sleep with your husband. It's so campy that it just stops things, and it's just so bad. But I do want to sort of reiterate, please don't watch this thinking it's going to be fun. It'll be, you can make a drinking game out of it. It's just like a waste of time. And I still have to watch more episodes, but it is shockingly bad. But it's not surprising in that Netflix, somewhere in their algorithm, you will agree with me on this, Jason, they decided that, oh yeah, like Fuller House, we'll take cheesy stuff. Cheesy works for some of our people around the globe. So that's, I'm guessing, why they made this show.
Yeah, it's funny. I was having a conversation with a friend about what we talked about last week, about like how Netflix in the post-licensing of other people's content era. And, you know, I wonder if they will make more attempts to do things that are more kind of like network TV fare, just because there's a segment of the audience that wants that kind of thing. Because this is from the people who did Scandal, right? So maybe they want to roll the dice with some of this stuff. But because it's funny, and this is what my friend pointed out last week, that their most successful content is these network sitcoms that have more than 100 episodes. Yeah. And yet, how many of those has Netflix done? They did Fuller House, which is going to finish with something like 80 episodes.
Right.
They did Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. They did One Day at a Time. There's a handful of those, but what I think is kind of interesting is Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is actually NBC Universal. I don't know what their rights are for that because they did buy it as an original. It is kind of fascinating. I'm like, okay, well, that's your bread and butter. Why do you not have a bunch of network sitcoms in the works for Netflix to replace The Office and Friends? And I know that that's hard to do, but I look at this and I'm like, okay, it's like Amazon having Bosch. It's like, well, let's try something a little more conventional because there's an audience for it. I don't know.
And Bosch does great.
Yeah.
Hugh Grant, by the way, was the character I was thinking, like, Hugh Grant wouldn't work in this either. He was one time Lothario, and I'm not sure he would pull off, and he's moved on to much older roles. A very
English Scandal. Yes,
he's so great in that. But I think that Renee Zellweger is sort of pushing it in this one. But to your question of why they did this, I mean, this is a Warner Brothers Television production. They just bought it from them. I think it goes back to the idea that Netflix is putting stuff in its mouth as fast as it possibly can. It's trying to eat up as much content and own, like, for the time being, own it, so that every day that you turn on your Netflix that queue and you see all, like, oh, there's hundreds of things. They still need, for the next, until November when Disney launches, they still need to root into your brain that everything that you want is on Netflix. And they're doing a great job of that. Like, eventually they'll move away from this kind of stuff. There've never been a high end HBO, like, prestige outlet anyway. It's about everything, but they'll move away from, like, picking everything. I feel like it's an Easter egg hunt and they're picking up everything off the ground, even ones that eggs that people stepped on or were not cooked, like this one. And they're like, oh, that's another egg for our basket. Let's throw that in there. That's what they're running around doing right now. I think in the next 2 years, they're going to be a little bit more selective. Because then the stakes will have settled out. Disney's not going to kill Netflix. Netflix is not going to prevent Disney from being a hit. But they still are in this mode where volume is our business. And so that they've snatched up something like What If. But weirdly, I still think there are people who go to Netflix for, they think they're going to get great content. I think they're going to get content, and you have to be very choosy.
So anyway, What If? Maybe not.
No. Yes.
Okay, we have two things from listeners. I think maybe being on Thursday has thrown them. They're confused. But we'll do them really quick, and then we'll be done. Our friend Jason on Twitter asked about this. Star Trek Discovery is on CBS All Access in the U.S. and on Space in Canada, but worldwide on Netflix. The new Patrick Stewart show, Picard, will be on the same places in the U.S. and Canada. But worldwide, it's going to be on Amazon Prime instead. He says, huh? That's surprising and a little confusing. I've heard this from some other people, too. It's interesting, since CBS is not yet ready to roll out all their content internationally, they instead just are happy to get a check written for them for outside of North America by a partner, and Netflix gave them a lot of money for Star Trek Discovery. It is interesting to see them make a deal with Amazon for this. Do you think Amazon just basically outbid Netflix? Is this CBS playing Amazon and Netflix against one another in order to get the best deal? What do you think is going on here?
I think that is a mess. I don't...
Right, because now Netflix isn't going to be the global brand of Star Trek streaming. Instead, if you're a Star Trek fan outside of the U.S. and Canada, you have different services with different Star Trek shows.
Yeah, it's to me, I think that where things in the streaming wars, and once you start to pare it down, you can get most of it from a business perspective of, like, oh, I know why they're doing that. I think when it gets into international and it even bleeds into, like, Canada and stuff, things become a little bit more confusing. I can't say I'm a pro at some of those rights deals and why they did it.
Yeah, and so. Disney has an international strategy. Like, there was a really bad chart that they put up at one point. It's a terrible piece of chart work, but it shows that they've got a rollout strategy for Disney Plus worldwide. They know when they're going to what different markets, and they've got a plan. I'm sure Apple has a plan. Netflix,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, and they'll get Hulu over there.
And they will
as well.
Get Hulu over there as the, you know, they'll pull, they have enough content that they can put it out without the reruns, basically, that are in the U.S., and it will be viable, and they'll push it out there. So, you know, Netflix and Amazon have international strategies. What's interesting is that CBS does not have an international strategy. And there's a question about what's the international strategy going to be for, like, Warner Media and Comcast. Because they've got lots of outside the U.S. deals, but presumably, I mean, you've got two ways to operate. You can either operate in North America and then just sell off your rights everywhere else, or you've got global ambitions. And I would think most of these companies have global ambitions rather than going through an intermediary in the rest of the world.
Yes.
And if that's the case, and you're, you know, CBS, it's an interesting, I mean, I feel like ultimately they will either have global ambitions or be bought by somebody with global ambitions. But for now, you've got this super weird state where they've got a franchise and they've decided that they are going to auction it off to partners. And they're either playing these two partners against one another, or Amazon really wanted a piece of the pie and stepped up to spend more than Netflix. My understanding is that all the Star Trek Discovery spinoffs are Netflix right of first refusal because they come from the deal that they made for Discovery. But this Picard show is not a Star Trek Discovery spinoff. And as a result, they were able to, you know, auction it off. I wonder if this is a CBS strategy to pit them against one another, or if it really is just Amazon saying, we don't want to let Netflix have all the Star Trek.
And it could just be that because there are no current international ambitions, or whether they even have the willingness or ability to go international, which I would doubt right now. Maybe CBS Corporation is basically just saying, let's just get what we can get for it.
Yeah, highest bidder.
Yeah, and then we'll keep doing that until we actually don't have another streaming plan anymore, and then we're bought.
Yeah.
And then everybody else figures out all the deals that we cut.
Then they're going to have to unwind all these deals where they've got it actually reduces CBS's value overseas, depending on how these deals are cut, because if you buy Star Trek, but you don't actually get the rights for a certain number of years to these shows because they already were sold to, if Amazon buys CBS, like, Netflix has still got Star Trek Discovery for some period of time, right? It's like, except in the US and Canada, it's like, it's not as good, right? It's not worth as much. I don't know. I feel like companies without an international strategy are going to feel the pain eventually, but they obviously don't care right now.
Yeah, it's like right now they're just saying, that's your problem for later. Yeah. Right now, give us your money.
Our successors will have to deal with that.
Yeah. But I mean, maybe that's the answer. Maybe that's our answer about CBS in the future. They, by doing this, they're saying, yeah, we're punting.
Yeah, we're just going to kick that can down the road for now.
Mm-hmm.
All right, one more letter. This is from Liz from the 510. She says, I followed Tim since his days at the Chronicle, but have never reached out till now. So long time, first time.
Oh, okay.
While I deeply miss the Death March with Cocktails and the Cranky Pants, I love the podcast. I had to write today to thank you so much for steering me to What We Do in the Shadows. Other than Veep, I cannot recall when I've laughed so very hard at a TV show, just rolling on the floor laughing and rewinding all the time to laugh again. I guess I could be mad that you're causing me to waste a lot of good wine through my multiple spit takes, but it's worth it. This is so what I need more of in my life. Without your recommendation, I doubt I would have found this gem. I sure hope they renew it. So thank you, and love to your mothers, Liz from the 510.
Oh, Liz, that's awesome. Yeah, it's I love that show.
I just started watching it this week, and I endorse Liz's endorsement. It is a spectacularly silly, funny, brilliant show. It's like a little bit of The Office because of the documentary style, but a little bit of like a more absurd show, like, I don't know, like a 30 Rock or something like that,
or
if you want to go all the way to the original This Is Spinal Tap, it is kind of like a This Is Spinal Tap TV show, where it's a, you know, a documentary-esque, but it is absurd. But the characters are all very serious, but it is absurd. It is amazing.
I love how just when you think they're going to run out of ideas, they don't. And then yep. They have these baked-in callbacks where the first couple of episodes, they're kind of funny when you first see them. But later on, they're pants-wettingly funny because they don't go away, and you realize that, oh, that's, you know, Laszlo's way of speaking, and the hissing, and, you know, the energy vampires, mm-hmm. Those concepts have played out, like, with just, you know, it's amazing. So I love it. Yeah. Love it.
Yeah, it's good. Also, I will throw in another one that I've been watching this week that I finally got to, which is Sex Education on Netflix.
Yes.
It's great. It's great. Mm-hmm. But we're lifting, Tim, we're lifting these off of your Power Rankings comedy list. That literally is what happened, is that we have sort of run out of other shows that we were watching, and we wanted something new, and we wanted to make it a little bit funnier. And what we do in the shadows is purely hilarious, and Sex Education is really good and well-rounded while also mm-hmm. being funny. And
yes.
And like it's kind of like an 80s movie.
Yes, on purpose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, very much about present day issues, but also kind of timeless, and it's really great. So
yeah, they have a lot of like wink wink nudge nudge there. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
There's an homage element that I get a kick out of.
Great use of the soundtrack. Good music supervision, yes. On that show. Lots
very
of good music on that show.
Very good. Uh-huh. So yep. Yeah, I'm happy to say that the comedy Power Rankings have been helping people through
yes.
difficult times.
Trying times, that's right. Mm-hmm. They can't all be grim, dark dramas, Tim. Sometimes you got to lighten the load a little bit.
And I think a lot of people, just to bring this full circle, a lot of people who are in the weeds about Game of Thrones, and will be probably for another week or so, when you come out, I think you need a comedy. I think you need two or three comedies mm-hmm. to bring yourself. I mean, especially if you're super disappointed, you know, let it go.
Dr. Tim has a prescription for you. It's
absolutely.
That list of comedies. There,
yes.
You watch The Tick. What we do in the shadows? Sex
what
Education
we do in the shadows for sure, right? Like, they should get into that immediately. Whew. That's a good bath,
yeah.
For all your anger.
That's right. It's like a bubble bath. Just to slide
bath.
On in and watch a bunch of vampires who lack self awareness.
Yes,
it's amazing. All right, so yes, Liz, thumbs up. Very good. And more people should write in, because, quite frankly, there were only two this week. And we don't have a big finale to spend most of the podcast on for next week. So definitely write in. podcast@tvtalkmachine.com is where you can email, or you can tweet at TVTM. And those are the best ways to reach us. And you think about recording your voice and sending it in, unless you're a vampire and don't show up on tape. You could do that. But then... Otherwise, we will be back on another Thursday in the future, yet another Thursday. But until then, we say...
Bye, everybody!
Goodbye, everybody!